Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jeff Dunphy on Blog Talk Radio. Jeff and Jameen show this morning. We're talking about retooling for our coming of age. It is Friday, December 13th, 2013. Today, just like Bosco and I have done in the past, we're going to talk briefly about gold. We're going to talk about the price of gold today. It looks like it's up about $10, maybe $11. And it's sitting at about $1,236.90. Also want to tell you a little about what we're going to do on the show today. We're going to talk about gold, obviously, because we think gold is a very important item to have and own and wear. We're going to talk about the headlines of what has come out this week, what has transpired, and not get too caught up in the headlines, but nonetheless inform you enough about the headlines. We're going to continue on with the 10 things that close an open society because we merely covered four last week. We're also going to chat about selfishness versus selflessness. We're also going to have a little chat about the Hunger Games. And with that, I would like to introduce you to my co-host, Jameen. Jameen, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Are we ready to get started with some chatting about gold? What's going on in the gold market, Professor?
Well, let's chat a little. We've had a couple of individuals pitch up and suggest that they've got some people running around telling them that the price of gold is going to drop precipitously. And I did a bit of research into this by one of our interested listeners, and thank you very much for the comment. We went and wandered around a bit, and in our wandering around, we make reference to a guy named Eric Sprott, and Eric Sprott is a business associate who I've done business with in the past, and whom I have an enormous amount of respect for. And he, earlier in sort of the late part of October, he wandered through and wrote an open letter to the World Gold Council. So you can find this on sprott.com.
And I will tweet that link out right now.
Wonderful. And we have the World Gold Council that Eric actually takes exception to how it's presenting what it's representing, its status. And it's not the first time that these statistics have come under pressure from the investment community. And what I would suggest is sort of drawing this up, and in fact, Jameen will post this or tweet this right away. But effectively, Eric urges the leaders of the World Gold Council, for the benefit of their own members, to improve the quality of their data and consequently find other sources than where they're using them, because he proposes that it paints a misleading picture of the real demand for gold. And consequently, the concern that the price of gold may go to 750, I am not for one moment suggesting that it won't go to 750, but I will tell you this, it will go to 750 on a manipulation, not on a supply and demand venue.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So for those of us who may be just beginning this journey, learning about gold and its properties and learning about why it's important to have gold, when you talk about market manipulation as it pertains to gold, how does someone who doesn't know that much about gold know when it's a market manipulation, or know when it's the right time to buy, or is there even a right time to buy?
Great question. If you go to the marketplace and you have three vendors of cabbages hanging out, and a head of cabbage is $3, and they're all selling for $3, let us propose that then you just go around and see which is the best looking cabbage. And consequently, maybe somebody's selling for $2.90 and somebody's selling for $3.10. That would be made reference to as a bid and an ask, and you go and you. However, what happens in the gold market, that the gold market itself, this is a conversation that Bosco and I had a few months ago, but the price of gold is not gold price. So that's when the price of gold you see on the screen is dramatically different than if you go into the downtown of Singapore, or the downtown of Hong Kong, or the downtown of Beijing, and you try to buy an ounce of gold. Nowhere in the world is an ounce of gold as priced on the screen. It is always more expensive, and sometimes it's more expensive by 2 or 3 or 4%, sometimes by 5 or 10%, and it's the same with silver. So the actual physical commodity itself is priced in a way that is inconsistent with the price you see on the screen. So now let's back that up, and let's suggest that you've got the three cabbage sellers, and one of them says, I have so much cabbage, or I want to manipulate the price of cabbage, so I'm going to put my cabbage for sale. I'm going to put all of my cabbage for sale for $1, So everybody goes, holy crap, we can't produce that. This is the gold producers. We can't sell. Well, and then everybody flocks to the cabbage and does this stuff. That's how they can use electronic trading to make the price of gold go down artificially. What they do
so
is...
So then you're talking basically about paper gold. You're talking about... So this metaphoric cabbage that's being sold for a dollar is actually cabbage on a piece of paper. It's not really the actual cabbage roll that you would get. So,
it's exactly right.
Okay.
No, it's exactly right. And part of the thing that normally happens, if they're trading 100 units of gold, whether it's a 1,000 ounces or they're trading 100 units here, 100 units there, 100 units here, that's all in the normal course of trading. But then all of a sudden you'll see, and this has been most dramatically pointed out by the J.P. Morgans, people watching J.P. Morgan, 100, 100, 100, 100, these are the trades. And then all of a sudden it'll be 8,000. So an 8,000 short on the market, which drives the price way down. So they create an artificial short electronically, not by selling 100 short, because that's in the normal course of a trade, but by selling 50 or 60 or 100 times more than the market normally trades. And that artificial manipulation drives the price of gold down.
Okay, so this individual or individuals who are spreading this rumor that gold would be priced at 750 at some point, they're not actually talking about a physical gold bar or physical gold pieces. They're talking about gold as in paper form?
No, they would talk about the price of gold. So then you would go to the vendor and pay $750 plus a premium to get a physical piece of gold. But the article that I was reading makes reference to the fact that there's a whole bunch of economic things happening that would bring the price of gold down to $750. And under the course of time, If in fact, in my opinion, the price of gold going to 750 is modestly irrelevant for the moment, because we really do think, and we'll talk about a number of these things right now economically, that would have gold be an incredible storage of wealth. And that's the demise of the U.S. dollar, or the collapse of the U.S. dollar, the removal of it from reserve currency status, because that's moving us also away from that. And it's also, as our friend Brent Johnson would say, there is an enormous exporting of physical gold from North America to Asia. And there's something about what the Chinese know in the country of India, the Indians know, that has them buying gold as fast and as fervently and as brilliantly as they can. So there's a whole bunch of things involved in there that make me think the price of gold is not going to be dropping precipitously if mankind in general can rise up, retool, figure out what in fact they're being told, and actually accumulate and buy it for themselves.
So what does this letter by Mr. Eric Sprott exactly state?
Well, he basically takes exception to one of the many pieces of information that they suggest in terms of, he thinks that the demand for gold is very strong. He also thinks that the supply of gold is far less than meets the demand of gold. And if in normal economic conditions, supply and demand balance each other out, if there's a lack of supply, the price goes up. And if there's a lack of demand, the price goes down. But because of the production of gold is so minimal, I mean, you don't have huge producers of gold. And because the price of gold has been so artificially suppressed, you have a whole bunch of miners saying we're not going to produce because every incremental ounce of gold that we produce costs us a certain amount of money. So his letter is on his website, and we've tweeted it, and I would have you, should you see fit, go in and read that. But let's get on to some other headlines, because I want to chat a little about the economy in general and where it's going and what's been happening. Okay, so I want to chat a little about the tendency of the Fed to print money, quantitative easing, this is called, and some would have it spoken of as quantitative easing to infinity. And this is the printing of money. So let's chat a little about the collapse of 08. And this is when they threw Lehman Brothers under the bus and Bear Stearns as well. The collapse since 08, let's chat a little about some of the bubbles that we're seeing. Now, I lived through the dot-com bubble when all of these pet food stores on the web were worth billions of dollars one day and worth nothing the next. Okay, so the stock market value of companies on the tech guys. So the NASDAQ US Technological Index, the technology index, has risen 55% since 2012. Okay? That's one. Okay, and now because we've got what's going on is called ZIRP, which is zero interest rate policy, you've got the low interest rates and the central bank bond purchases trigger a surge in the stock market. Okay, so the balance sheets of the important central banks, this is the printing of money, and what they do, they print this money and put it on their balance sheets. Their balance sheets have increased by 150% since 2008. Okay, so now let's chat a little about China. In China, they're doing the same thing. They're printing looser monetary policy, so they're printing money, and they're lending money out, so low interest rates. And what has it done? When you can borrow lots of money, it increases the price of houses. So the price of houses in Chinese cities, the big cities, which is where everybody's wanting to go right now, since 2009, has risen by 38%. Okay, so Nobel Prize economist Robert Shiller talks about the real estate market in Brazil as overheating, and since 2008, the house prices in Rio de Janeiro have risen by 2.3 times, 230%. Okay, so let's chat a little about London prices, as I was there not 2 weeks ago chatting about the apartment prices since 2012 in the last year have risen by 13%. Okay, and now let's chat a little about market indices. In Germany, the climb from record to record. The share price of mid-sized companies on Germany's MDAX, which is the index kind of like the S&P or the Dow Jones, has risen in 1 year by 83%. So guess what? Simple facts of those numbers speak volumes. We don't need to go and elaborate on that much more.
Well, I just wanted to say to anyone listening out there, we're actually looking at a really clever graph that was put up on Zero Hedge. And I've tweeted the link to that graph, and you can follow us on Twitter at retoolingdot.org. And you can also go to our website if you need any additional information. You need to see how to spell that, and our website is retooling.org. And so I think that this is a really lovely graph, and it's always nice to see these things in a visual format. But I noticed something on this graph here that you didn't really go into much detail on, and it's talking about London. And it says, actually, that in countries like Britain and Germany, investors are sitting in a particularly dense center of concrete gold. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I suspect there has been, you'll remember when the Germans asked the Americans, they wanted to repatriate their gold, and they had several tons of gold. And the Americans said, let us get back to you. We'll let you have that in the next 5 to 7 years. What does that tell you? You remember that cup that you borrowed some time ago? Can I come and get it? I don't know. Okay, maybe. I mean, it turns into a Saturday Night Live skit. I don't have it, right? I think that the context of this is that the central banks right now are not selling their gold because they recognize that at some point in time in the process of any collapse, gold is going to be the only thing that's going to have any value. Because the economy generally, since ZIRP has happened, the 5 years after zero interest rate policy has happened, the economy, this is the tool that the Fed uses. They just lower interest rates because then you can have money, but the economy has done nothing but slow down. And I think that also brings us into the not a revelation from where we sit, and not a revelation prophesizing, if you will, or perhaps projecting or forecasting, is that the global economies in every single country are slowing down. You've got people starting to withdraw. You've got people now starting to express serious distrust of their governments. You've got government and the populace that they govern are starting to have serious disconnects. And we're starting to recognize that government's agenda is not in keeping with the people's agenda, which is what we're going to chat a little about later on in the show.
And it's also the old saying, how long can you kick the can down the road, right? Like it's getting to the point now where that they're running out of lies, they're running out of schemes, they're running out of ways to keep the machine running in the fashion that it has been running for.
So, it's a perfect segue into this next little bit, and that is, when you have a policy, there's a lovely adage, when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging, Right? And it's the same thing that Bosco and I used to bounce around some time ago. And it's they've leapt off a cliff, and the cliff is using monetary policy to manipulate the economy, which they can't do, and it's clear.
Well, they can't do forever.
They can't do forever. And what they're doing is they're flapping, plummeting to the ground, and they're suggesting that if they flap harder, they're gonna fall less quickly, which is delusory, but
if they put a green screen behind them, we'll all think they're still flying.
Great analogy. Yes, exactly right. If they pretend and they, yeah, you know, it's the movie Wag the Dog. Yeah, exactly right. The other thing that's presented itself is the International Monetary Fund has just come out this October with a 60 or 70 or 80 page document talking about the globe and what's going on and what's happening. And one of the things that happens when governments are going, oh my goodness, we can't pay down our debt. In fact, lots of governments are borrowing just to pay the interest. But one of the things that happens in all of this is the IMF gets together and sort of looks at things and says, how best do we organize and bring money in? So you can do one of three things. You can print it, but when they print it, they want to see that the printing of it has an effect. They're seeing that it doesn't have any effect anymore. So now what they're doing is they're just spinning money. And that's when you get rampant either devaluation or you get rampant inflation, which is what has happened in Rwanda, what has happened in various countries throughout history. You also get lack of validity in the reserve world currency. You've got the global currency that everybody uses right now in transactions is the U.S. dollar. People are starting to, or countries are starting to, oh my goodness gracious, maybe it isn't as sound as it could be. So they're starting to trade in renminbi or in Chinese yuan. So the Asians are starting to have economic financial pacts that lend themselves or get themselves away from the U.S. dollar, because they know that when you print money in perpetuity rapidly, you have a devaluation of the currency. So there's that one thing. The other thing you can do is there's three ways that the government get money.
Before you go on, okay, for those of us who haven't recently taken our SATs, can you just define the word perpetuity?
Oh, okay, got you. Forever.
Okay, thank you.
Forever, eternally. So there's three ways that the government can raise money or can organize their economy. The first is through the taxes that they gather up. The second is through the printing of money and devaluing your currency. So as we said, in the last 100 years, the Federal Reserve Act was put into law 100 years ago, and the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar has dropped by 99%. 99%. So 100 years ago, $1 could buy you a basket of goods, and now it takes you $100 to buy the same basket. Shocking, but true. The 100 years before the Federal Reserve was in, the inflation rate was 1/95th of that. So what does it tell you? The Federal Reserve Act was put in place so that the bankers and the politicians, acting in collusion with one another, could devalue the currency and provide the economy with the lending of money, so they have to manage the interest rate. So it gets a bit, it's very self-serving. So the IMF comes out and says, and it's made reference to, they've dropped another bombshell, and they've said, you know, what they could do is they could start to tax people more.
Mm.
And what they could do is start to go in and steal people's money from the bank. So,
in other words, people who have saved their money, pensions, RSPs, things like that is what you're talking about.
That's exactly right. And so the IMF has suggested that they could increase tax brackets in various places. They're suggesting in the States, but they're suggesting by increasing the tax brackets to as high as 71%. Now, one of the things that my dad used to tell me in the 60s and 70s was he used to work 50% of the time or 60% of the time for free, which I didn't really get at the time because I was very young, but you think about that. You think about that 71%, it turns out that you work more than two-thirds of your time for free. So effectively, we would work 3 days and 2 hours a week for free, and you get to keep the other 1.5 days of work. Right? So
that's egregious.
It is. It's
when you think
outrageous.
About it, I don't think people think about it in that way, in those terms.
Yeah,
when you think
exactly
about it
right.
in those terms, it really changes the perspective.
Yeah, and it has lots to do with presentation. Like if their paychecks, if everybody got a paycheck and they'd earned $2,000 on their paycheck, and there was a line on each part of their paycheck that said, and we're taking $100 off to pay for our military effects around the world. We're taking $100 off to pay for this. We're paying. Everybody would take great exception
this
to that.
This amount
right?
of money goes to AIG for bonuses.
Exactly, right. This amount of money goes to the banks that are too big to fail. And so you get into a bit of a mess in that regard, okay? So we also have all these bubbles going on, and we also have the bankers telling the politicians what to do. And we've had some exposés going on in the guys that are inside the Federal Reserve that are starting to come out and raise that very premise, okay? So part of this retooling is giving people the opportunity to look at things with new eyes, because when you can see what is, you aren't necessarily inspired to see what somebody else wants you to see, or for fear of seeing the truth, you don't want to hide your head in the sand. So now let's chat a little about Iceland. Some time ago, the bankers that would be brought Iceland to the brink of the new world by allowing them to lever the dickens out of themselves. And so these banks levered themselves absolutely brilliantly. And consequently,
Iceland was the first bubble to burst, was it not?
Well, it wasn't so much the first. The Icelandic government and the Icelandic people said, the banks have failed, so we're going to let them fail. So it's a little different in saying all the other banks did fail, but the U.S. government and the European government said, we're not going to let you fail. We'll just print money to support you. So it is, again, one of those places where in a democracy, supposedly, if you try something and it doesn't work, the market allows you to fail at it. But what these banks did to the governments, the various governments around the world, is they said, we took this risk and it's going to blow up, but if we fail, you're going to face an economy. It's going to be really nasty. It's going to cost you votes. So the government said, oh, well, what can we do to help? The Icelandic guy said, no, we're just going to let the banks fail, much to the chagrin of a lot of people. And it pissed off an enormous amount of other banks who had money vested in the Icelandic banks. But what they've done now is they've said to the bankers, we're going to throw you in jail. And it brings us to the last part of our show today about 10 steps. And we're going to talk about how they play stuff like that.
Well, what I meant was that Iceland had been one of the countries that was working under this banking model where lots of money was being printed and false books were being kept and people were being lent money who could not pay the money back. And so the Icelandic banking system was one of the first to fail before what happened in the United States in 2008.
Right. Well, I mean,
the
banking industry in Iceland failed after 2008, but what they did is they let the banks fail.
I see.
They actually let the banks fail. They said, well, you blew it, so we're going to. And what also has happened in Iceland recently is they've thrown some of these bankers in jail. Okay.
Well, they have a very interesting society in general. In the headlines very recently, just last week, their country was in mourning because it had been the first time in the history of the country that a citizen was shot and killed by a police officer. And even though the man who was shot and killed was, he had a gun and he was shooting at people and he was mentally unstable, and the police officer that shot him was not wrong. He was not wrong in what he did in terms of trying to defend himself. The whole entire country went into mourning because they were so saddened that they had this stain on their culture and their history, because they don't carry guns. Their people have guns, but their police officers don't carry guns. They consider themselves to be a peaceful society. So I just think that's a really interesting fact, and it's actually nice to know that peaceful societies exist in our world.
God help us, right? I mean, the NRA some time ago thought that they should have armed guards outside all of the schools in the states. They actually proposed that. And I've been to various countries that have armed guards all over the place, and guess what? They don't make you feel safe at all, right? It is a horrible, horrible thing. So one of the things that happens, and I want to get back to this taxation thing for a bit before we move on, and one of the things that happens in terms of the governments, the IMF suggesting that we increase taxes, other guys suggesting that we're going to be printing money in perpetuity, and also the fact that, well, if we can't print money and it isn't working, let's go in and steal money from bank accounts. This is called a bail-in, and they're further and further along the road of proposing bail-in procedures.
Legislation.
Right. And so one of the first questions is, if you knew your money was going to be unsafe in the bank and subject to confiscation, would you put it in the bank? Well, simple question, simple answer to that. Now, one of the things they're going to do is they're going to say, nobody who has less than $100,000 in the bank, we're going to touch. And so everybody goes, oh, phew, well, then we don't have to worry about it. However, if you're smart and you realize that if you have $100,000 in the bank, that it's subject to confiscation, you're going to take your money out of the bank. And let me tell you, there will be a point in time when people take their money out of the bank, if they're not already doing it, and parking it in a place where it's safer than the potential of the bank. So this is part of the preparatory thing and the retooling. You retool by recognizing that your cash is not safe in the bank, even if you have $10,000 in the bank. I would suggest it isn't necessarily safe.
But wouldn't you also suggest that previously in this conversation we were talking about inflation and we're talking about the value of cash, and cash is obviously still very useful in our society. However, wouldn't it be more useful to invest that cash or whatever is extra into something like gold and silver, which will actually be more of a valuable commodity in the upcoming future or near future? Isn't that the suggestion overall?
Well, there's...
I mean, talking about bubbles and collapses and talking about inflation, and these things are all tied together. Complex as it may seem, they're all tied together. Am I right?
Absolutely. there's two perspectives. The first, I mean, there's a great old adage that says, buy something that appreciates, rent something that depreciates. Okay, so if that's the case, if it costs, it is now costing you money to have a bank account. Recently, I have a savings account, and they didn't charge me anything to have the savings account. So I had the same 100 units of money in the savings account for a period of time, and I hadn't touched it for months and months and months. And then recently, I looked at it, and I saw that the balance had changed. They're now starting to charge me $20 a month just to hold my money in a savings account.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it is.
It's disgusting, especially since they use that money to make money for themselves.
That's exactly right. So it's
so on top of that, they're taking money out of it, which...
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So it's usury. It is ridiculous.
Now, question. I keep getting this image of people with wheelbarrows of cash. You know, this whole idea of what was the word you used earlier?
I can't remember.
Anyway, this endless creation of money by the Federal Reserve and
printing money in perpetuity.
There you go. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. So printing money in perpetuity, and at the same time the lowering of value of that money.
The devaluation, yeah.
People with wheelbarrows of cash trying to buy things at the grocery store.
In the Weimar Republic, in that time in the 30s, where their currency devalued by 1,000% in a matter of days, you would sell a cow on one day and you'd have to go and spend that money because the next day it wouldn't be able to buy a loaf of bread. I mean, that's how bad it got. Now, is that where it's going? I'm not sure. But let me tell you, when a currency devalues, and many currencies have devalued all over the world. George Soros was a brilliant investor in terms of this, but many currencies have been devalued over the world. And he's known as the man who broke the Bank of England, and he's also known he bet against the Mexican peso when it was devalued. And what the governments do in terms of their devaluation of their currency is that, are you going to devalue? Nope. You're going to devalue? Nope. Nope, 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 nope. And then at midnight, the day before they devalue, at 11:59 and 59 seconds, they go, okay, we're going to devalue tomorrow, because then nobody can escape the system. So what they do is they lie to you through their teeth, and they present this that says, and now we're going to devalue the currency. Now, the globe and the global traders are devaluing these various currencies given their economic insight into what's happening, but also the wise traders on the planet are buying gold as rapidly and as passionately as they can because they know that gold and silver have intrinsic value. There's no party risk, the physical gold. There's no counterparty risk, and there's not an infinite supply of it, as there is printed money.
Now, I think it's important to talk about fear-mongering in a sense, because I think that this type of information to someone who's just hearing it for the first time or to someone who has invested their belief in the banking system, in the government, in the systems we have in place, and they're hearing something like this for the first time, one, they're either going to say you're full of crap, or two, they're going to be very scared of the prospect of losing everything that they've invested their life savings into to some degree. And so I think it's important to talk a bit about fear and also the resilience of the human species and how resilient we are as a species, and how no matter what, even if there is a collapse tomorrow, we'll figure it out.
I think throughout history, we have had rises and falls of empires, and then within those rising and falling of empires, we've had little chapters of good times and bad times. I do think that we as a human species have an incredible resilience, and I also think we're now starting to recognize that we are all connected. So this outrageous greed, this snowball gaining more and more momentum as it's rolling down a hill, will have an effect. It has had an effect. It will continue to have an effect. And it will not end well. It cannot help but end poorly, merely because it is based solely on greed. And when push comes to shove, when nasty things happen to people, the people themselves bind together, bound themselves together and say, what can I do to help? Which talks about a great phrase that I've used in university on many times, and that we use in teaching all kinds of things. And it's called, as go we, so go I. The government is not in the business for your best interests, and they've fed you a bill of goods relative to that. They have been in the business of maintaining themselves in power. And the cross-threading, the cross-manipulation of governments and corporations in facilitating their own agendas has been hidden in plain view for a long time. And more people are starting to come out and say the governments don't give a dickens about the population, nor do big corporations. Big corporations are selfish in their pursuit of profits. And we lose sight of all of that because they're feeding you a bunch of nonsense. So no, the banks are not out for your best interest. No, the government's not going to take care of you. And no, corporations don't give a flying flip about anything but more profits. And then they learn how to game the system. They learn how to game the system. They learn how to, what's it called, salting dice? Or when you go to Vegas and you have a special pair of dice that always rolls you sevens, loading the dice. They learn how to manipulate the system. And that's a horrible thing, but guess what? More and more and more people who are on the inside are coming out and saying that's exactly what they're doing.
So then for the housewife or for the working mom or for the working dad or for the individuals who are listening who are very busy in their everyday life, they're plugged into the system. Maybe they work for the government. What's the tools for those individuals to be aware of what is happening, be able to continue in their lives and not be... I get the sense sometimes that when people learn about these things, when people hear what's really happening and they start to begin to wake up to the reality of our government and what is actually being perpetrated against us by corporations, governments, media, what have you, the Goliaths of the world, they short circuit. They just can't.
They get overwhelmed.
They just short circuit, and instead of figuring out how to stand up for themselves or say something or learn more, they tend to just ignore it.
Hide their heads in the sand. Yeah, I mean, and that is by all intents and purposes. That's how mainstream media and that's how the government would want you to do that. the mainstream media and the government want you to think that you're going to be okay because they will take care of you. So the aspect of retooling, the first is becoming more self-reliant. The next is recognizing, and this happened to kids in my class who were from Britain. We haven't seen it in Canada yet, but we will. There was a Barclays bank in London had a computer glitch. It's a bank that has a computer glitch. And for 1 week, nobody could access their bank accounts electronically. For 1 week. So all of their debit cards. Now, how could you survive for a week without a debit card?
I think that's cruelty.
Yeah, well, and particularly because it's their money. Now, one of the things that a lot of people think is, well, I don't have $100,000 in the bank. I don't care. What happens if your debit card didn't work for a week? We as a society, Canadians more than even Americans, we as a society use our debit cards almost exclusively.
Well, in the United States, funny that you should bring this up, a couple of months ago, there's something called an EBT card. And it is like a welfare card. So instead of getting food stamps, you have this EBT card. And I'll tell you in one second. It's called an electronic benefit transfer card. And so what happened in the United States was these cards stopped working. And so these people who already have no money, and it doesn't matter what side of the fence you sit on in terms of whether you believe in social welfare or not, it's irrelevant to this argument, but those people who were depending on this card to buy food, literally a loaf of bread, literally, mm-hmm. couldn't access their benefits. And so, you know, it's on a large scale and a small scale that these things are possible.
Oh, absolutely. And would that have happened around the time where the debt ceiling argument was going on with the Americans?
I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, so part of the stuff that happens is let's see. Let's look at all these things and let's see. Do you have enough food in your house that if a nasty snowstorm came, you could eat and provide for your family? Do you have enough cash in the house, in your bank, even in your pocket? Do you have enough cash? Not in a bank. Do you have enough cash that you could manage for a week? A month? 2 months? 3 months? How much food do you have in the... This is just pragmatics. It's not. Now, when you see a Barclays bank in London, their debit cards don't work. When you see these EBT cards not working, these are little signs. These are little signposts of when and how to pay attention.
Let's finish up the 10 things that close an open society, because we're actually touching upon some of the remaining ones, and we'll weave this conversation into these remaining facts, these remaining factors of how you close an open society. What things do the governments do? What things do the elite do? Things do the corporations do? Those who are in power, whatever you want to call them, what kinds of things do they do in order to close down an open society? And before we start this, what is the reason why they would want to close down an open society?
Okay, let's do a bit of backtracking and talk about inclusive and exclusive societies and governing bodies. Okay. Inclusive governing bodies want everybody to prosper, want everybody to do well so that the economy in and of itself prospers. And when economies are growing and when everybody is benefiting and when everybody is growing and selling their products and goods, that's an inclusive economy. And the government finds those economies really easy to rule. The exclusive economy is where the ruling elite, and we all see this all over the planet, but it's just well better hidden in the States and Canada, where the ruling elite try to take as much as they possibly can out of the economy, which effectively merely hamstrings the economy, compromises it, takes the wheels off the economy, and the economy grinds to a halt.
I mean, it cuts down on ingenuity, creativity. It cuts down a lot of things that an inclusive society allows.
Right. And it goes to the old adage, what's in it for me, as opposed to what's in it for us. As go we, so go I. That will be the new mantra as we wander into this new time, is that we are going to collaborate. And we talk about the three C's in society being collaboration, cooperation, and collectivism. We cannot continue this selfish role, R-O-L-L. The ball is rolling down a hill in selfishness. It does, by its very nature, implode on itself, okay? So let's dive in. The last thing we chatted about in terms of 10 steps to close an open society was surveilling citizens in the NSA.
We had a huge conversation about privacy on our last show. So if that's something, it's a really hot hot topic right now on the tip of everyone's tongue. So if you want to go back, you can head to our website, which is retooling.org, and there's links there for all of our shows.
And so consequently, I saw a lovely little cartoon about the NSA sitting on Santa's lap, looking at Santa going, I know when you've been naughty and I know when you've been nice, right? Because now the NSA is doing all this surveillance. It's fair to say, ladies and gentlemen, that there's nothing happening that the NSA isn't involved in and spying on and listening to.
However, not that I think that that comment should not instill fear in anyone, because just because they have the information does not mean they have the manpower to actually understand, filter, look through the information. I believe that they're basically holding that over our heads to keep us in fear, but I don't think that they actually have the ability to look through anything. So
okay, let's chat about step five. Step five is called infiltrate citizens groups. Now, after the 08 crash, a whole bunch of people parked themselves in Wall Street. It was an Occupy Wall Street movement. And it was Occupy Wall Street movement because they took exception, as we do, to the way the banks had just used incredibly egregious manners in which to manipulate and get the government to bail them out. I kind of blew my brains out, Obama. You got to save me. Otherwise, you're not going to have a whole bunch of voters to vote you back in. Hell. Okay, right? Twist my arm and away we go. So during the Occupy Wall Street, the media would ask citizens that obviously had no idea what was going on, mainstream media. So what's Occupy Wall Street? And some guy would go, oh, no, man, I'm just here for the hot dogs, or I'm here for the grub because somebody told me I could eat. And what they do is they completely undermined the message of Occupy Wall Street, and that was the big banks and the governments were in collusion to violate the very fabric of Esgo, we said, why? It was in it, let's in it for them. So during this, mainstream media just trashed the actual Wall Street or the infiltrate citizens groups by discrediting them.
Yes, and you can see this many times, and I have been involved in many protests. I've been involved with many activist groups where you know the people that you work with, that you've organized this protest with, you've organized this action with, and all of a sudden these individuals that you've never seen before show up and start burning cars and start violent acts, and they're called provocateurs. Like, they're not part of the actual movement, but they're sent there to give the movement bad press.
This
happens all of the time.
There you go. I mean, and it violates the integrity of the movement. If they knew better, they would do better. When people start to pitch up and tell the truth, they're thrown under the bus, aren't they?
A really good example, too, is for those of you out there who enjoy television and movie references, there's a show on a Netflix original series called House of Cards, and the part where they're going through this whole education strike, and the government, they infiltrate the people who are striking against the government. The government actively goes in and infiltrates it. And it's a television show, but I'm fairly positive that people think this way. I've experienced it personally.
Yeah. And again, it parks – this was Mark Leibowitz's New York Times guy saying that you go to Washington to get rich. You go to Washington to manipulate the system so you can lobby and get paid millions of dollars in lobbying fees. And again, it's a play of how do I play the system to work for me? I used to be in the system. I used to see how they manipulated it and played it and how egregious the manner in which they did it. So let's get on to the next step, because there's a bunch of things in here happening that the next step is detain and release ordinary citizens. Okay. And part of the detaining and releasing ordinary citizens or suggesting that normal people compromise the integrity of the whole is either aligning them or telling everybody, oh, they're involved with terrorists. They're involved with terrorists because what they've done is sort of showed everybody that we've been lying to you through our teeth. So they're obviously involved with terrorists.
Naomi Klein actually wrote a book called The End of America. And it's also a documentary as well, so you can either watch it or you can read it. And the book talks a lot about all of these steps, and it talks about how Yeah, and the same similar thing happened in Hitler Germany as well, where at first it was the outsiders who were the bad guys, and then it became the Germans who were bad guys, the bad guys who were helping people, hiding people. So, and then and the same thing happens in the United States as well. Like all of a sudden the terrorists look like this, but now terrorists look like everyday Americans. So yeah.
It creates a scenario where everybody becomes really paranoid and everybody is ruled by fear. Okay. The next step is targeting key individuals. Who would be the key individuals that we've targeted of late?
I think Bradley Manning is a really good example of someone who was made into a scapegoat and was imprisoned for a very long period of time without any hearing, without any due process.
Absolutely. And consequently, again, part of it is these little dupes, as the government would view them. These little dupes are just standing in the way of the government, the U.S. government, just acting in a manner that is just in keeping with keeping itself in place. And so what they do is they grab these individuals, they target them, and then they tell everybody that they're treasonists or they're full of espionage, when all in fact they're doing is exposing the egregious behavior of the governments.
Mm-hmm.
So number eight is restrict the press. Well, we've seen this before. We've been there before, right? The old movie about William Randolph Hearst that was done in the early 20s by an incredibly brilliant filmmaker. Who was that filmmaker? I can't remember who the filmmaker was either at this instant in time, but basically William Randolph Hearst absolutely destroyed this guy. And this guy was considered, in Hollywood, he was considered... He was considered, in this movie, it made this media baron out to be an evil guy. And it talks about the restriction of the press and how William Randolph Hearst had all these newspapers and he could tell you and
oh, was it Citizen Kane?
It was Citizen Kane. There okay. you go. Citizen Kane. And it was, and who did it?
Hold on.
Who was the...
Orson Welles,
there we go. Okay, my apologies, ladies and gentlemen, for getting lost on that one. Orson Welles was blackballed and tarred and feathered by William Randolph Hearst. So now let's chat about convention. Okay, so conventionally, or time right now, the restriction of the press is scary because the press not only is not free and open, mainstream media is bought and owned by how few companies?
Well, I think that restricting the press is an understatement as it pertains to the reality of what is really happening. But I'll tell you a really interesting story. I live in Canada, and so my mother came to visit me in Canada. This was a couple of years ago, and she was watching the CBC News. She was watching the CBC. And I walk into the room, and she's crying. And I asked her, why are you crying? And there was a scene on television that was showing outtakes from what was happening in Afghanistan at the time. So there were children and mothers and women crying and people being killed and dead bodies on television. And she said, we don't see any of this on television in the United States. They don't show us this. We don't see any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge... indicator to me that
there's great censorship going on.
Exactly.
About how they manipulate what they present as the news. Well, I think in terms of the US military, I think if the plot line for the US military is to no boots on the ground and not putting good American soldiers in harm's way, so they do this by what? Using drones, using remote warfare where there are no cameras, there are no television cameras. And when either the Afghanis or the Iraqis or anywhere where they want to play a hand of presenting what in fact the Americans are doing or any of the United Nations are doing in terms of their bombing stuff, they show YouTube or video clips and we're caught in the, oh, well, is this real or is this not real or is this staged or is this not staged? So it's been an interesting thing. Okay, so we don't believe in, we believe they're restricting the press. We don't believe, we believe the press is bought and sold and does not truly represent what's up.
So here's a quote for you. We as conscious individuals have the obligation to seek and speak the truth. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, it's one of the mandates of those who choose to retool and figure out what's going on. If they don't, they get sold a load of goods, as Bosco would say, and they lose the capacity to complain when life happens to them. They lose the capacity to complain when life happens to them. Okay, step number 9, recast criticism as espionage and dissent as treason.
This is happening all over the place.
How dare you tell me what I'm doing is bad? You're bad. Like it's wagging fingers, right? It's how dare you tell people what we're doing? How dare you expose our skullduggery? You must be bad because you,
skullduggery. Yeah,
that's a great word, isn't it? And
finally,
step number 10 is subvert the rule of law. And one of the things that the Icelandic banks have done is actually thrown bankers into jail. But one of the things Matt Damon did a movie called.
I know Matt Damon movies, so you described...
He was the narrator of a movie that talked about how the banks screwed everybody
over.
Oh, yes.
I saw that movie recently. Hold on.
So, I want to make reference to a guy named John Corzine of MF Global. He was a Goldman Sachs guy. But he used his MF Global, and he stole $2 billion from his clients. And when it went to court, when the judge said, oh, you know, that was they were just being stupid. They weren't very smart.
Inside Job.
The movie Inside Job.
It's on Netflix.
And in fact, it won an Academy Award as a documentary. And one of the things that happened in all this, at the end of this movie, The Inside Job, they had a very simple thing that was quite scary, and it was nobody has gone to jail for the very fact that they did all kinds of nasty, nasty things. Now, it is coming out sooner, later and later and later in time that a lot of these people are being fined. But the whole issue with these fines is that they're happy to pay the fines when they don't have to go to jail. And I, you know, so here are the 10 steps that we've, you know, we promised to chat a little about and talk about how generally speaking, the powers that be are involved with all of these. And it lends itself to paying attention. Wake up and smell the coffee.
So we sent you, Jeff, to finally go and see the Hunger Games. So I actually gave him an assignment to watch the Hunger Games, number one. I think it's called Catching Fire on...
Second is called Catching Fire.
Hunger Games 1 and 2. So we're both up to date on Hunger Games. What did you think of the Hunger Games? Because it brings up an interesting conversation in my point of view of the whole idea of selfishness versus selflessness. And what does that mean for us as individuals who are trying to make the world a better place? And this movie, which is a pop culture phenomenon, lots of people have seen it. The actress from the movie is on every single magazine. What were your thoughts on the movie?
Okay, we now park ourselves into pop culture, if you will, but we also park ourselves into how the directors and the writers of these things are making statements about society. Now, from a macro level, these movies are absolutely great. The subject matter in this movie is a bit hard to take, and consequently, the premise is that the government has the 12 districts of which they send children to fight to the death. It's like a game of Survivor, but only worse. They have to kill each other, and only one survivor wins.
King of the Mountain with really sharp weapons.
That's exactly right. And so, but there's something insidious to this that is something that we need to pay attention to, and it's the movie maker and the book writer, the author. The message itself is that there is a government out there that may not be in the best interest and is certainly involved in quelling or suppressing or ruling or being extractive in their approach towards the economy, towards the civilization, towards the planet.
And it also shows this very large gap. And the movie is obviously dramatized. It's a dramatic version of what is happening now, but there is a large gap between the rich and the poor. There are people who live extremely extravagant lives, and the rest of the world is living in poverty. So that part of the movie is true.
Remember we talked about Inequality for All, that this guy named Robert Reich, it's a documentary movie, and it's on the web, and you can see it on Netflix. Inequality for All goes on to say that the gap between the wealthy in America and the poor in America has been getting wider and wider and wider constantly. And so the message of this movie speaks in parts to the very message of this other movie called Inequality for All, that Robert Reich, who, by the way, is the ex-Secretary of Labor under Clinton, who's been wandering around waving this flag going, you have no idea what is happening here. The discrepancy between the rich and the poor is getting bigger and bigger. That speaks volumes, and it's not a movie, in my opinion, from where we sit in terms of retooling, it's not a movie to be missed, because the next iteration on the movie, the one movie ends in a place where there is a very selfless act, and consequently it launches the powers that be into, oh my goodness, how can we control and manipulate? And what they do is they say, we're not going to be controllable or manipulatable. So they take an action that brings about clearly the next movie, and the next movie is a progression and an unfolding of people collaborating in order to facilitate something for the greater good.
Now, we don't want to spoil the movie. We're not going to give out
Rogers and Ebert, yes.
We're not going to give out any spoilers. But we do suggest that you might want to go out and see both of them, just because of these. There's a lot of concepts in there, too, that speak about hope, the difference between fear and hope, and the difference between a population living in fear and what they're actually capable of when they have real hope. And not, I'm not talking about Obama hope.
Right. A bit of a misnomer.
I'm not talking about that type of hope. I'm talking about the possibility for a real change in human experience. And so I want to talk about this concept quickly because we're running out of time, of selfishness versus selflessness. And does one need to be selfish before they can be selfless?
It's a great paradoxical, philosophical question. And let us say this. When you get the phrase, as go we, so go I, you start to identify that in your best interests is to make sure that the collective is happy and prosperous and aligned and gracious and kind to the whole. And when you recognize that by propagating that thought, that mindset, that direction, everybody will prosper, prosperity will abound. And as soon as you switch to the other side of the tract, as soon as you say, what's in it for me, you start to violate the very fabric of living in the world in alignment. You start to live in the world in self-serving. So it's we talk about this the ancients talk about this, is living in the lower realm as opposed to living in both realms, aligning your lower realm with the higher realms. Allowing yourself to live inside the laws, the cosmic laws, the laws of nature, as opposed
to diving into a really deep subject with only 2 minutes left. We might have to continue this subject at the beginning of next show, if that's okay with you, because I want to pose the question to everyone, something to think about between now and next week, is if our intention is to make the world a better place, do we not have to make ourselves better first? And how do we go about doing that in a way that also benefits those around us simultaneously? Is it possible? So I think we don't have any more time beyond that. But I just want to urge everyone to check out our website, retooling.org, and follow us on Twitter at retooling, B-O-T-O-R-G.
Well, Jamie, not only have we opened a whole bunch of doors, not only have we scratched the tip of the iceberg, we've also, I trust that this proves to be of some use to all of you, and I trust that you will keep not your cynical hat on, where you are dismissive of other things, but your skeptical hat on, and that is being able to think for yourself, being self-reliant, being able to rely upon your better judgment and knowing that your judgment, your knowingness is more important than anybody else's. Having somebody give you a convincing argument is one thing, but unless you do the research and unless you grab or embrace the various points of view and recognize that each one of them brings something to the table, even if it is completely erroneous, many of them may have points, but let's be open-minded so that we can come to our own conclusions. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Bye-bye.